This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. This summer, North Carolina lawmakers had their hands full with the budget and the lottery. Still, they did have time to engage in a little debate about stem cells, namely whether the state of North Carolina should provide funding to support stem cell research. Stem cell research in particular, research using embryonic stem cells, is one of the most debated and divisive issues in science. The federal government under President Bush has already set guidelines about what kinds of stem cell research would be supported with federal government funding. So why would the state of North Carolina look into it? Joining us to answer that question is Mark Binker, a reporter for the Greensboro News and Record. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Not a problem.
Why would the North Carolina legislature consider funding stem cell research?
The sponsor of the measure, Representative Earl Jones, basically has looked at other states where they've done something similar, New Jersey and California, and he's looked around the southern United States and seen that nobody else has done it. And he said that one major reason to do this is to make North Carolina the regional center for this type of research, that he believes the state has a real opportunity to take advantage of a gap that's not being filled right now.
And he's talking about taking $10 million from the state's tobacco settlement, right?
Mm-hmm. It's from something called the Health and Wellness Trust Fund that was funded by the tobacco settlement money.
Now, what has happened to the bill?
It has been sidelined for the moment. It got a couple hearings this summer and never made it past the committee stage. Right now, it's the House leadership has sent it to what's called a study committee, which basically is an opportunity for them to look at the issue, consider it over the interim between whenever it is the legislature happens to adjourn this summer and when they come back next May.
Groups for and against this have testified before the state legislature. We know on the national level it's a pretty hot issue. How about in the North Carolina General Assembly? Is this going to be a big issue next term?
This session, it hasn't had the profile of some other issues. You mentioned the lottery and some of the other budget debates, but the issue of stem cells itself is as you said, so volatile on its own that it tends to attract some rather passionate debates, no matter where it shows up. If it manages to have a good study committee, if the study committee actually does something with the issue, yeah, it could come back and be something for the legislature to consider.
Well, that's a big if. A study committee in other states, that is the death knell for legislation. How about here in North Carolina? Does that mean it's sidetracked for the year, or is there something going to happen to this bill?
Study committees are quirky things, and it really depends on the folks who staff them and what they use them for. One example I would point to, for example, is the bill that came out of the committee over the last interim to reform how the voting system in North Carolina. That bill was very high profile and very controversial, and had a lot of different points of views that wanted to be heard, and eventually became law. And if the folks who staff that committee and who are on that committee actually do bring it up to speed, do use it as a way to air the issue in public, they may actually have a shot at bringing the issue back to the legislature. If they just let it sit fallow over the winter and don't do anything with it, then yeah, it's probably somewhere where the idea has been sent to die.
All right, well, we'll be watching. Thank you, Mark.
Not a problem.
Mark Binker is a reporter for the Greensboro News and Record. We're talking today about the proposal to use state funds to support stem cell research in North Carolina. Lawmakers are studying the issue over the break between legislative sessions. Joining us now are three people who will be closely watching the debate play out. Suzanne Kirby is a professor of pathology and stem cell researcher at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Robert Cook Deegan directs the Center for Genome Ethics, Law, and Policy at Duke University. And Tad Poholchek is director of education at the Catholic Bioethics Center. And I want to welcome all of you to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I was going to welcome phone calls this hour at 877. I almost forgot I had three people. You're all very welcome. And welcome your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Should the state of North Carolina be in the business of funding embryonic stem cell research? Is it even necessary? 877-962-9862. Suzanne Kirby at the University of North Carolina, you're doing this kind of research. Do stem cell researchers in North Carolina need state funding?
Yes. You know, the NIH has been able to fund some stem cell research throughout the country, but the amount that was given last year was $24 million. And compared to some of the other countries that are funding this kind of research, for example, the United Kingdom has designated $175 million per year, and Australia $43 million per year. with the government budget issues going on in this country for the last several years, we don't see that there's going to be able to be a huge increase in the amount of funding available through the NIH. There are private nonprofit companies that fund stem cell research, for example, the Stem Cell Research Foundation, that funded 6 grants recently to the tune of $1.8 million, but that's only 6 researchers. And private companies right now that are interested in this kind of research are kind of keeping their research in within their own company. So,
but that's let me stop you there. That is research, nonetheless. Is that enough?
A lot of what is being done in the companies is trying to develop tissues that can from embryonic stem cells that can be used for testing drugs. And while that is going to be useful for hopefully for helping develop new drugs that would be helpful for patients, it's not necessarily going to generate tissues that might be useful for patients. And that will generally involve needing to have, ultimately to have clinicians involved after the basic science is worked out, and it's a very expensive proposal, and I think most small companies may not have the funds to do something of that breadth, in addition to having the controversy over human ESL research. There may be issues with their contributors and stockholders for them doing that kind of research.
Let's talk a little bit about the science. Embryonic stem cells, how are they different from other stem cells?
Well, so basically adult stem cells have a very limited capacity from what we know so far. Most tissues do have some, or many tissues do have some resident stem cells, and probably the most well-known and well-used version of that is bone marrow stem cells, and there have been thousands of bone marrow transplants done around the world, and they've, you know, been very successful in many cases. However, there are a number of problems with adult stem cells from other tissues. One is that they are much harder to get at, and two, all of the research that has been done so far has shown that any tissues that can be repaired or regenerated or from adult stem cell sources other than bone marrow, replacing bone marrow, it's extremely inefficient. And the other thing that's different about adult stem cells is they have a much more limited lifespan and also a much more limited capability of what kinds of cells they can become.
Let me ask. I want to bring Robert Cook Deegan into this discussion at this point. He's the director of the Center for Genome Ethics, Law, and Policy at Duke University, to talk about precisely what is the promise. Do we know what the promise is for embryonic stem cell research? And maybe what it is not, because there certainly has been an awful lot of talk about this kind of research.
We know what we hope the promise is. A lot of the questions that are in the air have to do with a lot of the debate has been about whether embryonic stem cells are needed or whether you can get to the same places by using adult stem cells. And we should, one thing we might do for your listeners is explain that when we say adult stem cells, we mean stem cells that are taken from tissues that are from a body of an adult person. So what it means is this is something that's like a skin cell. It turns out that in recent years, sometimes we can get cells to behave more or less like earlier stem cells. Like we can make them form tissues that are not the same as the tissues from which they were derived. So that's made us hopeful that maybe eventually we could make an adult stem cell still do most of the things that you can get an embryonic stem cell to do. It's an open question whether that's ever going to be possible. And one area of research that almost certainly we will never be able to get at that way is not necessarily about clinical benefit, but it's about early differentiation. That is, how does a fertilized egg become a human being? It seems very unlikely that we're ever going to be able to answer those kinds of scientific questions about human development without being able to use embryonic stem cells. Now, the debate, however, is about the status of the human embryo. And if you think that a human embryo is a human being, then destroying that embryo is killing a human being. And that's, there is deep moral disagreement about the status of those embryos.
Well, let's talk to Ted Polacek about that, Director of Education at Catholic Bioethics Center. You testified when the state of North Carolina began studying the question, and you object to the idea of state funding. Tell us why.
Well, I think largely because of the point that was just made by Robert Cook Deacon, that the question of the status of the embryo really is central here, and it doesn't take that much reflection to see that a very simple analogy sort of breaks it open. If you think about the bald eagle and its egg, we have laws that protect both of them equally because we recognize that that egg contains the embryonic eagle. And if you destroy even the embryonic eagle, then you will destroy a bird of the same species, just simply a younger member. So the human embryo is much the same, and the same sorts of legal provisions should be made to safeguard early human beings.
On the State of Things today, we're talking about whether North Carolina should fund embryonic stem cell research. My guest will be back, and we're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Stay with us. Support for the State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Stem cell research, one of the most divisive issues in national politics these days, has been a subject of debate in the North Carolina State Legislature. This session, lawmakers proposed state funding for the controversial research that would make North Carolina the only state in the Southeast to financially support stem cell research. We're talking today about what that funding could mean to stem cell researchers and what makes stem cells such an ethically difficult subject. We're joined by Robert Cook Deacon, director of the Center for Genome Ethics, Law, and Policy at Duke University. Suzanne Kirby is a stem cell researcher at UNC Chapel Hill. And Tad Poholchik is director of education at the Catholic Bioethics Center in Pennsylvania. We're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Suzanne, what is the kind of research that can be done? What is the promise in stem cell, embryonic stem cell research?
Well, it's still very much in the early stages of development. As a matter of fact, only this month there was a conference of 75 scientists from 15 different countries at Jackson Labs where they were trying to establish criteria for defining different human embryonic stem cell lines. 2 years ago, during the second of the International Stem Cell Research Society's meeting, I would say maybe 10% of the presentations had to do with embryonic stem cells. This past June, when the meeting was held in San Francisco, there was probably 40 to 50% of the presentations had to do with embryonic stem cells. So researchers are just now beginning to learn how to work with these cells and to know what the potential may be. It's useful to note that of the presidential lines that have been approved, only there was originally thought to be 60, but there's only around 20. None of those are actually going to be useful for human tissue transplants because they've all been contaminated with by being grown on mouse cell lines and possibly contaminated with mouse viruses. So for anything to be done therapeutically in the future, new cell lines do need to be established and have been established that have been free from any such exposure to animal products. And
Right now, we should say that that Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist has said that he would support legislation in the Senate that would allow stem cell lines to be developed from in vitro fertilized eggs. That would certainly open up many more lines. How helpful would that be?
That would be extraordinarily helpful. The other thing that can happen with cell lines in culture over time is that they can accumulate genetic mutations, abnormal chromosomes, that may change the way that they function. And then there is also a phenomenon of, this is not so much a problem with embryonic stem cells as adult stem cells, of cells undergoing telomere shortening, and which means that they sort of lose their ability to divide over time.
So you want to keep regenerating those, coming up with new cell lines. I want to go to the phones right now. Kathy is on the line from Oak Ridge. Hello, Kathy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I love your show.
Well, thank you. You have a question for us?
Well, I just really had a comment. I just never really understood why this was so controversial. I mean, I know with the pro-lifers and everything, it's a political issue. To me, it's always been a health and, like, this medicine issue. The first time I ever heard of stem cells was during the Reagan years. And, of course, they were totally against it and didn't start, you know, developing it back then. And that's why I applaud Nancy Reagan so much now for coming out for it. And I just think, you know, if we had started back then where we could be now, and because everything that I ever read about stem cells, it's like the new hope for the future and curing all these horrible diseases. And, you know, I just never have really understood the controversy, because something can be done good with these embryos instead of just being discarded.
Well,
and
let's put that question to Tad Poholchek. He would not like to see funding for this. And let's put the question to him, and thank you for your call, Kathy.
Yes, I think the caller's comments are very emblematic of a situation that we find ourselves in this country, which is that people have heard so much of this speaking about promise about embryonic stem cells that they have bought it hook, line, and sinker. And in point of fact, all of the cures that have been happening in human patients have come from the adult-type stem cells, which, of course, are not morally problematic or objectionable. Nancy Reagan, you know, jumped on this bandwagon, and it was very unfortunate. I mean, in the sense that there was absolutely nothing that embryonic stem cells would have been able to have offered her husband. And as the researchers are immediately able to acknowledge, this is a long-term project before one can begin to consider using these cells in human patients, because of the tumor formation potential, because of the immune rejection problems, and what will actually be necessary once the physiology of these cells is well understood is to then go in the direction of therapeutic cloning in order to get matched stem cells for patients. And this is something that the vast majority of Americans are very opposed to. They don't realize how tightly interconnected stem cell research and human cloning really are. So, you know, the issue here is to clarify where the real promise lies and to realize that there are morally acceptable and non-objectionable sources, two of which have not even been mentioned so far in today's interview, namely umbilical cord stem cells and stem cells derived from placentas. And there's a lot of very exciting research from these two areas that's indicating a great deal of flexibility in these cell sources, in some cases perhaps even as flexible as the ones that are gotten out of embryos.
Well, let's put that question to a researcher in this area, Suzanne Kirby. Would umbilical cord and placenta stem cells work just as well?
Well, currently, the stem cells from placenta, that's a very recent research, and has been reported by one laboratory in Pennsylvania. And will need to be studied by other researchers before the full potential can be developed or understood. As far as cord blood transplants go, there have been about 6,000 cord blood transplants, mostly for genetic diseases or leukemias and things like that, and they can be quite successful, particularly in children, but they have not been used to repair nerve diseases or other than you know, Krabbe's disease, which is really not involved in nerve cells directly. So I don't think it's fair to say that cord blood cells can substitute for embryonic cells, because the potential for them to develop into all the different 200 different types of cell types we have in our bodies is just not been shown yet.
Well, let me put a question now to Robert Cook Deegan, because there is a kind of circular reasoning here. I want to cut right through it and get to the next question, the big question that it raises. The circular reasoning is there's a lot of hope, there's a lot of promise. This research can really transform our medical, you know, world in many ways. But we won't know what that is until we do the research. And there's the circle. And so you say, well, we have to do the research or we won't know how good it is, and it's going to be great, which seems like we're not really there yet. Now, here's the question. If there is a promise of great medical breakthroughs, why aren't private companies, pharmaceutical companies, just climbing all over themselves with their money to do this kind of research? And shouldn't it be up to them? Does the federal government or state government have to fund this research?
So, it's a great question, and to some degree, you know, most of the private R&D in this area has, until recently, been from relatively small startup companies. And if you look at the history of biotechnology, that was actually also true for monoclonal antibodies and for recombinant DNA. It turns out that the companies that first see the promise of a new technological area tend to be small ones. It's not unlike computing and telecommunications and software, where hot new ideas tend to incubate first in smaller companies, right, and then they get picked up by the larger companies. Mm-hmm. Now, larger companies are doing a lot more of this stuff. They're beginning to do it in lots of the countries that have been mentioned, including the United States. But the fact is that a company generally gets interested in supporting research only when they can connect it to their bottom line in the foreseeable future. And I actually don't think that most of this research is in that category yet. So the honest answer is we don't know if you can get to all the places we want to get by using adult stem cells. The tragic answer may be that the answer is that, yes, you can get to all the same places by using adult stem cells, but you only get there if you push them to the same point that you've got the same moral dilemmas that we have with embryonic stem cells.
Well,
those cells become so like an embryonic stem cell that they can grow into a whole human being, in which case the moral difference disappears. It's quite foreseeable that some of these adult stem cells will end up being pushed to that level, and we can actually reproducibly turn them effectively into human embryos. That's kind of what some of the research that's going on in other animals is demonstrating. But so it's a circuitous logic. You're absolutely right. So what is it based on? It's based on basically historical faith that if you pursue a line of research, it's going to come up with something. Can anybody claim actual cures at this point? No. Would we expect to be able to do that on stem cell lines that were discovered in 1998? That would be pretty surprising, since it usually takes about 20 years for something to go from the lab into practical application. We would actually expect to see most of the action here beginning in the second half of the next decade. So at this point, I think it's a little premature to know whether the promise is going to pay off or not, and that's why we call it research.
Tad Poholcek, what about that at the Catholic Bioethics Center? If we can't know what we don't know, so can you say that we can do everything with adult stem cells if we don't do the research on embryonic stem cells? Can you actually say that with any certainty?
I don't know that one can, because I don't think anybody really has the facility to predict the future. So your point is well taken. What I think the level of the discussion needs to be on is not simply comparative in the way that we've been meandering thus far. The question needs to be, are there certain kinds of science that are intrinsically unethical? Do we want to direct the enterprise of science in such a way that we make sure we safeguard certain human goods? And I'm convinced that we need to do that. And I think many Americans recognize the raw power of science can be used either for good or for evil and exploitative ends. And embryonic stem cell research, when it requires the direct and intentional disaggregation of a young human being, is always of that character. So in that sense, I think we need to ask the ethical question first, and then recognize that the great cleverness of scientists, if they acknowledge the ethical boundaries, the cleverness of scientists will provide wonderful venues using morally acceptable approaches to derive treatments for patients in the future.
Let's go to Chapel Hill. Janet is on the line. Hello, Janet.
Hi.
You have a question?
Yes, my question is for your last
speaker, and that is whether he is also against in vitro fertilization, since that's where most of the cells come from for embryonic stem cell research.
All right. Thank you, Janet. Ted?
Yes, that's a very good question. As you know, I am a Roman Catholic priest, also trained as a scientist, and the net result, I mean, what you would expect given that set of realities, is that indeed in vitro fertilization does represent the first step of the slippery slope that has led us to where we are. I'm convinced that in vitro fertilization basically flew in under the radar in 1978 when the first IVF baby was born. And I recognize this is a bigger discussion that will take us away from what we're focused on in this program, but let me just answer the caller's question and affirm that I am convinced that in vitro fertilization is not an acceptable way because it substitutes for the great gift of the marital act between husband and wife with a technical act, completely substitutes that love-giving act with a mechanical, technical act, and introduces a whole dehumanizing dynamic because of that. So yes, I'm convinced we shouldn't have gone down the in vitro path, and that is definitely a big part of the problem of why we're debating the question of destroying early human beings now, 25 years later.
Suzanne Kirby, are you concerned that you find yourself in grayer and grayer territory ethically and morally, and that ultimately this research is going to leave you in a moral dilemma personally?
I think personally my views are I'm fairly comfortable with, and I would hasten to add to the previous speaker that, you know, most of the people in this country are for in vitro fertilization, and it certainly has been supported even by many Catholics and many religious right people. When you look at the number of frozen embryos that are available right now from in vitro fertilization, there's somewhere between 300,000 and 500,000. 2% of those are designated to be discarded, 2% have been designated for adoption, and 3% have been designated for research. And if you just used that 3%, you could develop at least probably 300 new cell lines. If you look at what happens to the frozen embryos when they do try to use them, only 24% of them will lead to a viable child. Most of them are not viable, and many of them that are frozen because they appear abnormal at the time that they're developed. So there are certainly plenty of available sources right now to develop new cell lines without having to create any new embryos.
Let's go to New Hill. Rama is on the line. Hello, Rama.
Hi. I just would like to make a comment about an article I saw in the National Geographic. I saw a picture which showed an embryo, human embryo, with a, I don't know if it was an electron scanning microscope, and it showed this small cell or group of cells sitting in the head of a pin. And just the scale of it, the head of the pin, the whole of the pin took up the whole page, and there was a small, tiny red dot in the corner, and that was, you know, that's what we're talking about, the embryo. It's at that point it became clear to me that the people with a moral dilemma, it just seemed a bit of a stretch to call that something that's harming a human being.
Well, Rami, you do know what that turns into eventually.
Well, I know what a sperm and an egg turns into, and I also know what these frozen embryos turn into or can turn into as well. But, you know, at some point you have to say, you know, what are we really protecting here?
Thank you very much for your call, Rama. 877-962-9862. How are we conducting this debate? I mean, what are the terms of the debate? Robert Cook Deegan, are we all talking about the same thing? You've heard Tad say we really need to focus on this as an ethical issue, but on the other hand, there's some profound ethical issues having to do with the research and the health benefits of the possible research. Are we talking to each other or around each other during this debate?
There's a lot of both. But I think that he did ask a very legitimate question. Is there a line of research that is inherently unethical? And our society's actually answered that pretty clearly and decisively, and the answer is clearly yes. If you consider somebody a human being, you have to do two things. You have to get that person's permission to do research, that's informed consent, and you have to have independent external review of the research before you go forward. And we have elaborate rules for doing that. We can't cleanly apply that framework to this situation because an embryo is not yet a human being and cannot decide and cannot engage in informed consent. So we're actually in a gray zone. And in this area, it actually turns pivotally on whether you believe that a human being is a human embryo is the same as a human being. And in Catholic doctrine, that is very clear and has been for about 100 years. And it's, you know, I salute them for being very straightforward in pursuing that line of argument. The fact is that most Americans are not there and are not convinced by those arguments any more than they are on in vitro fertilization. And that's why we have a really vigorous debate. But it is turning on the status of the human embryo and the degree to which it should be treated exactly the same being as the same with the same moral status as a full-grown human being.
We're talking today about public funding for stem cells and other research that raise moral questions. We're talking with Robert Cook Deegan of the Center for Genome Ethics, Law, and Policy at Duke, Suzanne Kirby, a stem cell researcher at UNC Chapel Hill, and Tad Poholchik, Director of Education at the Catholic Bioethics Center. And taking your calls at 877-962-9862 when the state of things continues. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Statio. We're talking this hour about what it means for states to fund stem cell research. North Carolina lawmakers have considered it. California, New Jersey are states that have already committed to it, and many people oppose the use of embryonic stem cells for research on moral grounds. Does that mean the government should withhold public funding? How much does scientific progress depend on government money? We're joined by Robert Cook Deegan of the Center for Genome Ethics, Law, and Policy at Duke University. Tad Poholchik is Director of Education at the Catholic Bioethics Center. And Suzanne Kirby is a stem cell researcher at UNC Chapel Hill. Taking calls at 877-962-9862. Robert Cook Deegan, before the break, you talked about how this debate is being conducted. And the fact that the issue turns on whether or not we can call certain kinds of research moral or not. The interesting thing about this debate is that there's nothing illegal about this research. So the whole question is whether or not public funds should go. And that ultimately becomes, it seems to me, strictly a political question. Is it not?
Well, I think politics is how we solve problems when we've got moral disagreement. And that's what we've got left. That's why I think this is in the political arena, and that's where the battles are being fought, and I think quite properly so. They don't always tilt the same way in different jurisdictions. They're reaching different conclusions. Korea, Australia, and the UK have reached very different conclusions from the United States and Germany. So I think it is necessarily a political question when we've got moral disagreement. That's where we find ourselves.
Let's go to Raleigh. David is on the line. Hello, David.
Hello. Well, I'll try to make this quick, but, you know, it's obvious you're simply drawing a line somewhere. And I think it's pretty reasonable to draw the line way on the side of being okay to use stem cells because I don't know if this is a silly comparison or not, but, you know, when you flush a sperm and an egg down the same toilet, you've pretty much got an embryo there waiting to happen, and no one worries about that. It's a pretty thin line from that step to getting the egg and the sperm together in a petri dish. And it seems to me that I think there should be a line. I think there should be sensitivity, but allowing us to use sperm, the stem cells that would otherwise just be thrown away or sit there for 100 years, I just don't see a big difference between that and, you know, what people do every month when they flush their eggs down the toilet.
All right, Tad Poholchik, what is the difference? Thank you, David.
Well, the difference is a very significant one in the sense that speaking about sperm and egg, speaking about gametes like that is a completely different discussion than speaking about embryonic humans. And the question of whether there may be the loss of, for example, gametes in the toilet, and whether by some random action 1 in 100 million probability that you might generate an embryo somewhere in a sewer system is a completely different kind of discourse from the question of whether, with my own human intentionality as an acting human person making moral decisions, I should be bringing together sperm and egg, generating early embryos, freezing them, keeping them in that kind of cryopreservation for decades or even centuries, and whether indeed I should then be making the decision to destroy those vulnerable embryonic humans. Now, that earlier caller mentioned that they're sitting on the head of a pin, that they're very, very tiny, and it seems like a stretch. You know, when I speak to groups about this, I always have a line that I use to them. I say, as a former embryo myself, I have strong opinions about how embryos should be treated. I think we forget our own very humble origins. And once we do that, we've opened the Pandora's box in a direction that we really do not want to go in the future, where the weaker members of the species become fodder, as it were, for the more powerful and the already born.
What about, we heard Robert Cook Deegan a little bit earlier talk about what might happen to adult stem cell research as they're pushed closer and closer to the line of being essentially embryos themselves. Are you concerned, Tad, that this will that this may happen and that we may have this debate all over again about adult stem cells?
Well, what Robert is speaking about is a procedure called dedifferentiation. And dedifferentiation means taking basically an adult stem cell and sort of treating it with chemicals and making it more and more like an embryonic stem cell. And there's not any fundamental moral problem with doing that, so long as you allow that to go only to the point of what we call pluripotency. He suggested that we might be able to reach the point of what's called totipotency, where it becomes a zygote, a fertilized egg. If you were to go that far, there certainly would be a problem. But most researchers recognize that this is already an extremely difficult procedure to carry out. And if you do it and can control it in such a way that it only goes to pluripotency, this will be a wonderful solution because you don't make any embryos and you don't destroy any embryonic humans. So I think that, you know, his expression of concern at this point is highly premature and unlikely to be any kind of a practical issue in the future of dedifferentiation.
All right, let's go to Bob in Durham. Hello, Bob.
Yeah.
You have a question for us? Bob, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Yeah.
I wanted to follow up on Dr. Kirby's comments. She was giving information about the vast amount number of embryos from in vitro fertilization that were frozen. I believe she said that there were a lot that were not used because they're known to have deformities or they would be unviable. Is that correct?
There are many that are not used to implant because they appear abnormal or they're not growing well. And even when they have tried to use frozen ones, only 24% of them actually work to actually create a viable baby.
So my question is, for those embryos that are known to be unviable or to have deformities, would those issues not also render them undesirable for stem cell research?
That's a good question, and we don't know. It's possible, but the ability to get cell lines that might be useful from those is asking less, I think, of the cells than actually creating a child that would be viable through the whole term of the pregnancy.
And is that an area that of interest specifically in stem cell research, that pursuing the extent to which those deformities or unviabilities would affect their use for therapeutic purposes?
Yes, I think that would be an area that would be researched if there were more of these, frozen embryos available.
Robert,
one of the things that one needs to remember in doing this kind of research, and this kind of came up with, recombinant DNA work and also with in vitro fertilization in the early days, is one reason to have governmental funding for this kind of research is because you could then put restrictions on what can be done. If it's done with private money, there's, you know, the restrictions are only from the people who are giving the money. So, you know, it's important to think of that aspect in this type of research as well.
Robert Cook Deacon, as you look at this debate now and think about how science has put us in this gray area over the past, you know, however, century or so, do you think attitudes have shifted? Have we come to accept more and more as, let's say, morally acceptable? Has the line shifted, a line of acceptability shifted over time as science pushes the frontiers farther and farther?
I think the answer is a little complicated. I don't think that the concepts of what's moral and immoral have changed very much. I do think that we have come to accept lots of technologies that were initially opposed. And I would include in vitro fertilization in that. I would include recombinant DNA in that. I would include cell fusion technologies like monoclonal antibodies. These were all things that seemed a bit scary at the beginning and have come to be a mainstream part of the culture. That does not imply, however, that that's always going to be the case. So there may be places where we do finally draw a line and say we don't go that far. For me, embryonic stem cell research is not in that zone. But I think over time I might be convinced of that if I found out that it was in fact putting us on the slippery slope that Dr. Paholczyk said that we will be on. You don't get on a slippery slope and end up at the bottom of the mountain instantaneously. You usually start slipping. And I can imagine that we would have a very vigorous debate about, oh my gosh, we really are slipping and maybe we better take a second look. But I'm not there yet.
Robert Cook Deacon, thank you very much. Director of the Center for Genome Ethics, Law, and Policy at Duke University. And thank you, Suzanne Kirby, a professor of pathology and stem cell researcher at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And also Tad Paholczyk is director of education at the Catholic Bioethics Center. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for having us.